Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore. We're glad you are tuned in. Today we start a new book, Shelter Half, written by Minnesota author Carol Bly, a novel about a few people in a northern Minnesota town. It was published by Holy Cow Press in 2008 and is shared with permission. We received this commentary from Connie Ellis, the reader for the book, who had not been familiar with it before being invited to read it for our program. She read it through first to help her decide about recording it and shared these thoughts. I finished Carol Bly's Shelter Half yesterday. I enjoyed it and felt I really got to know Carol through her characters. She was generous with sharing her feelings with the reader. Some chapters stand alone as stories, and there are very many characters popping in and out of the book. I found it best to read without trying to remember who is who, but just to enjoy each section as it rolls along. It's quite fascinating. By the time I got to chapter 10, I couldn't put it down. Some real feeling in there. We hope you too will enjoy each section as it rolls along. Let's get started now with chapter 1. You will hear this book in a total of 20 episodes.
Shelter Half by Carol Bly, Chapter 1. A young woman's body lay for over a week in mid-November, undisturbed by human beings. Then, one Friday morning, an old strawberry farmer named Dieter Stoltz got sight of it because he was crouched not 4 feet away in the highway ditch. He was helping a wounded hunter climb onto his back so he could carry the man up the embankment of Minnesota Highway 53. There lay the corpse with its face edged in blown leaves and a little snow, its face half turned to him. Some creature had eaten one of its eyes. If Dieter Stoltz hadn't had the hunter getting onto his back, he would have shown his flashlight for a better look. As it was, he didn't even pause. He grasped his man's legs, pushed his neck against the fellow's hands like a horse of goodwill putting its shoulders against harness. He scrabbled his way up the embankment. It wasn't yet 6 o'clock, so the smooth highway was dark. A few lights of St. Fursey shone a mile to the north. Above them, the sky drew back its hood of stars. Dieter Stoltz had risen much earlier in his usual way. He'd been married for years and years to a woman whose face had stayed motionless during whatever comment he was making on any subject. If she had been still alive on this cold morning, he could have told her about the mother bear and 2 cubs who robbed their Harrelsons and a hunter caught in a Kona bear trap. However, he didn't wish her there to hear about his scared feelings. She'd been a wife who obeyed a law of manners that said, "Wait your man out when he is speaking." So she had never interrupted him. On the other hand, her motionless eyes were like the gun and cannon muzzles of a tank still pointed at you well after its captain or crew had died inside. He did not rise some days at 4:30 or 5:30. He rose every day at 5. Even this late in the fall, he carried a cup of his grainy coffee out onto his cabin stoop. Like other poor men who acquired property in middle age, he felt grateful for it every day. His stoop looked out over a small lake that still had no jet skiers thumping on it. Its fir trees were dying off at the south end and reseating themselves at the north end, as evergreens did, all over the top tier of the United States. But the change was slow. His heart wasn't constantly broken over reminders of global warming. As his father had in Germany, Dieter grew winter apples for the sake of their sharp bite. The moon had lighted his path along the lake. Like others who were 78 years old, he had to stand still for a moment after 10 minutes sitting with the coffee. But once the stiffness melted away inside his legs, he swung off the porch easily and went fast along the path. His hair was white now, not so thick as it had been, but thicker than most old men's hair. Most people in the town of St. Fursey called him a character, as they tended to call anybody who had some foreign accent. Worse, Dieter Stoltz could read musical score and was apparently educated, but somehow had a low income anyway. The man Dieter had bought his land from 12 years ago, Peter Tenebrae, was never called a character, or even quite a character, by anyone, because four generations of Tenebraes had had money. Sabi Iron Range money, what was more. Women occasionally went after Dieter. The Episcopal Church shared an emergency organist with other churches in the area. One was Pearl. Pearl ran the St. Fursey post of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, and she gambled hard at the Black Bear Casino outside Duluth, and at the Grand in Hinckley, which she determined had looser slots than others. She was one of the worst organists outside the Twin Cities. She noodled chords. That is, she rambled around the circle of fifths, resolving dominant sevenths into tonics while Lutheran pastors crossed from lectern to altar or from altar to side chair during a service. The Episcopal rector, a woman named Eliza McGinnis, told Pearl that she mustn't noodle slop in her church, however, because the Episcopal Church had a canon against it. Noodle slop. Pearl's face went stony. She herself knew she was a quick read as an organist. There were many, many things to do in life before one wasted hours and hours in organ practice. Also, since when did some 25-year-old woman, getting herself up in a cassock and all, and intoning who knew what at the altar, had the right to call an organist a noodle slopper? Pearl didn't end bar at the VFW for nothing. She stood Eliza off. She said, might she ask what in the name of heaven was a canon? The young rector explained. Then Pearl smiled. Pearl said, yeah? Maybe you don't need my services anymore. But Eliza had been rector at St. Fursey for nearly 3 years, wasn't shaken by the usual blackmail that organists use to face off clergy people. Eliza smiled. No, Pearl, we all need you in town, and you know it. I need you at my church. We all need you, and we especially bless you for accompanying the ecumenical choir rehearsals each fall. Pearl had been the first of several women who hunted down Dieter Stoltz after his wife died. Pearl was realistic. He obviously was some kind of a gentleman or something, even if he was a German immigrant. He went to the Tenebrae's fancy weekend dinner parties. He was a musical person who held the whole tenor section of the ecumenical chorus together. Pearl was only a gambler and a bartender and a slipshod organ player, so she didn't want to marry Dieter. She simply knew in her heart of hearts that he would be a totally robust dream in bed. She wanted him just once, she thought, the way she had wanted a few other men. George Herlich, for example. She always made it clear they didn't get to ruin her life. She didn't want to ruin theirs. The German strawberry farmer had said, don't explain that to me, Pearl, and took her into his cabin several nights. Where did you leave your car? Was all he asked, since she hadn't driven right up his road. She had left it outside the abandoned solid waste transfer station. She explained that people would assume she was illegally dumping or shooting rats or shining deer, she told him. Half the town sneaked in there, killing things, target practice, building tree houses, all the crap that people do. Tell you the truth, she had said to Dieter. She liked animals herself. She liked people who owned them, and she didn't like people who shot them for fun. She liked men who talked in bed. There were hundreds of things to talk about in the world, so people should talk about them. She never spilled drinks when she hiked trays of them around the good old VFW on a crowded night. She was also careful-handed, oddly tentative-handed with Dieter. She unbuttoned his woolly shirt gently, as if she were his valet and he were a European dignitary, not just that character around a northern Minnesota town. The gentleness of that rough woman's hands poured into him and stayed with him. After Pearl came Emma Jean Tenebrae, who was far too young for him. At that time, 4 years ago, she wasn't even 30. They never talked about her failing marriage. If only he had been 40 or even 50, he would have asked her to marry him. But he had been 74. On this particular morning, two of his still-unpacked Harrelsons had been smashed into. Whole branches had been smashed into and spoilt. A third tree showed signs of bear nesting. High up, the animal had crunched together enough small boughs to make a rough platform. She must have sat there quite comfortably, probably to feed. He approached, but deliberately. It was one thing to observe last night's work by a mother bear, but another to find oneself right there under the trees with her. People at Denham's Bakery Cafe had been talking about a mother bear and two cubs. They had been around town these last 2 weeks, feeding up for winter. Dieter bent to sniff a new dump, rich and sweet, a powerful tincture of apples. Well, exactly, of course, his Harrelsons. Likely a few dozen pounds of them. Under 1 inch of the scat, the small grass was still green. He went on double guard, whistling Talus's cannon to give the bear fair warning. He now made out at least one cub's trail as well. He crept along listening. Only the lake's moonlit wavelets patted and stroked the shoreline. Then a branch broke close ahead of him, to his right, and above him. A huge bear, sitting at her ease, a good 15 feet up. Just below her, one cub clung frantically to the trunk. On the ground below stood another cub. An apple fell. Another. The cub on the ground dashed over, but then looked upward at a loss. Its gigantic mother descended, cracking and dropping small branches as she came. A number of apples fell. Her huge bottom knocked down the cub who had been hanging by claw holds. Dieter waited until all three animals had moved off southward, ahead of him. They kept to the shoreline, as he meant to. He recalled how Pearl, that usually rough-spoken organist, had said she liked animals. So did he. But he never started conversations with mother bears and cubs. He gave this one a good 5 minutes lead time. Presently, he heard splashing. She would have slogged out into the water, and the cubs would have followed. Dieter was close enough to hear her throttle-like call to them. His intention was to turn west onto the rough track that led toward the highway, passing along the south edge of the old dump enclosure. From there, he meant to walk the mile into town and get a hot chocolate, mit Schlag, from Denham's Bakery. He supposed the bear family would keep to its southward course along the shore. Dieter turned into the woods now, unlighted by the moon. He didn't turn on his flashlight yet. Then he heard from behind him sharp rifle fire. Next, a man screamed. Dieter trotted back toward the lake. He turned on his flashlight and waved it about. He set up a shout, "Coming! Help coming! Shout again so I will know where you are." The male voice cried out again. Dieter kept shouting, both to cheer up the hurt man and to notify the mother bear that he was returning to the lake shore, that although he liked her and her cute cubs very much, he did not want to be clawed to death, so she should clear off. He made out his man half sitting, half lying, right at the shoreline, at the place where a small stream ran into the lake. Dieter assumed the man had been drunk. He did not like coming upon drunken grown males in the woods. They usually had equipped themselves inwardly with rotgut and outwardly with firearms, with the safeties left off. If they had gotten into the woods by driving north from Duluth or St. Paul, they generally shot around happily for a while, then got lost and felt cross, and with luck found their cars, tailed off southward on 53 and Highway I-35. This one was a local man. Dieter approached warily. He saw no rifle. "All right," he said, "I will help you." It was a fellow named Brad Strop, the no-good husband of a cleaning woman at St. Fursey. Dieter knelt near him and went over the man's extended leg, turning the flashlight down the calf to where a small animal trap had bitten onto the ankle. The trap was a conibear, a 330, Dieter thought, set for open water. The trapper had baited it with two fresh-cut young poplars, so its chain pulled downward underwater just offshore. Dieter propped the flashlight to beam onto the ankle. He stood up, looking for a pry. "What's the delay?" cried Strop. "Your rifle. I need something to lever it open with," Strop swore. "I don't have any rifle with me," he said. "And no shotgun? Why would I have a gun or a rifle around this time of year?" Strop cried. "Jesus, will you get a move on?" Dieter thought to himself, "All right, then." He knelt as far as he could rest on his heels, took hold of the bar, one breath in, back out, another in, held it, and brought the bar slowly back. Strop didn't know how lucky he was. Dieter now slowly lifted the badly wounded ankle off the cut steel. Dieter said, "All right now, you have to get up. Hang on to me." But he had to lift him. Finally, they got going. Three-legging it together, arms around each other, like soldier and wounded comrade. Dieter kept talking so that Strop would keep moving. Dieter said conversationally, "Didn't have a rifle with you at all?" "I told you no," Strop said. "Did you hear a couple of shots?" "No, I didn't." Strop was panting now, likely from the pain. Both men were tired, so even Dieter's desultory remarks petered out. Their path had been down leaves and light snow ruffled together. That would be Strop's own trail from earlier, Dieter thought. "Good, we will find the car on the highway shoulder." If Strop had come without a car, Dieter would let the man sit down on the shoulder and he himself would beg a ride. At least a few trucks would be coming past by now. It must be close to 7 o'clock. They came out of the pines and shoved through the opening edge of fireweed and other bramble. Then onto the highway, clearance width of 12 feet, its scrub mown down twice a year by the district. Dieter paused here. He had forgotten about the 7 or 8 foot rise to the highway, surface level. He looked left and right, hunting for some spot with less gradient. No good. Yes, well then, he would have to get Strip up on his back. He noticed a place where someone had scrabbled up the slope up or down it, the leaf and ragweed and scant lupine overturned not so fresh as Strop's other track. More snow still floated on many of the leaves. "All right, Strop, here we are. Your car up there. Good. I'm going to carry you. Here's my back. Get aboard." Dieter got down on all fours facing up the incline. Then Dieter saw something else. A few feet from his right lay a human body, arms and legs flung out. Its smallish head was tipped and partly facing Dieter. The body must have frozen earlier, and now one eye cavity was half watered with yesterday's partial thaw. About a week, Dieter supposed, but his knowledge of exposed corpses was now over a half century old. For one amazingly stupid second, he went for his flashlight. Instead, he said heartily, "Hang on, then. Here we go." He carried Strop up the grade, set him down, and asked for the car keys in a perfectly ordinary voice. Dieter put Strop into the passenger side, went around and got in. Straight stick. Okay. Clutch, lights. Dieter drove slowly because half his brain seemed to scarcely work. Then he sped up some. "That's more like it," Strop said in a jeer. Dieter kept the car at 50, even into St. Fursey City Line and nearly to the emergency entry of the hospital. The ambulance door rose. A nurse with chilled arms across her chest, cardigan sweater drooping over her shoulders, came running crabwise to Strop's car. A second nurse approached with a wheelchair. Once those two women had him in hand, Strop talked to them like a little boy. Dieter, listening as he followed them into the wide bay and down the hall, was reminded of how you have lain wounded, sickening and cooling and in danger of never being found at all. When people approach in the uniform of help, whites or soldiers with Red Cross, it is immediately all right to let go of adulthood. You change back to a child. Bradstrup chattered like a little boy to the nurses. Someone left a beaver trap on that path. The fool, you'd never catch him setting a line where people walk. Dieter half attended. He waited for one of the nurses to finish calling the doctor from a wall phone. He took the phone, but waited until she was out of hearing range. The dispatcher came on first. Then the St. Fursey chief of police said, Stoltz, Dieter, you wait for me right there. I'll be outside emergency in 2 minutes. Dieter went back outside, where day now filled the sky. It weakened the lights of the auto dealer's sign. His left hand was trembling. At 78, one trembly hand wasn't bad. He knew that trembling came on as soon as a person could unload some scary job onto someone else. Now the chief of police drew up, lights blinking, no siren. There's an elegance about even a small-town officer's car when you've been waiting for it. There is an elegance about an officer himself, even if he is just a village chief of police, not a president of a country. The stripe down Bernie Stokowski's pant sides was the symbol of force and help. Like anyone else, Dieter knew that the USA standards to qualify for a local cap were supposed to have sunk like the standards for every other job, but still, the stripe had snap. All Dieter had to do was tell Bernie about the dead body. Hop in, Dieter, Bernie said. The heater warmed the car. South on 53, right? Dispatcher said the old track by the solid waste transfer site. Runs right along the south fence of it, Dieter said, down the embankment, just at the bottom. Bernie told him, so what we'll do, you show me everything, I call in for help, you tell me everything you know about, and then Daryl Hill will give you a ride home. For the first time, Dieter took in that younger man in uniform who sat in the back seat. At the solid waste transfer, Dieter pointed. Bernie said, okay, will you turn to right here? He gunned the car around and stopped. Now, he said. Get out of the car, but don't walk around on the shoulder. Just stand right beside your door. Point her out to me, he said to the young man who had leaned forward to open the back door. No, you stay put, Daryl. They could see the girl's body perfectly clearly. It lay exactly as Dieter had remembered it. But now it was not night, but day. And it was only the dead body of someone he didn't know. He was not afraid anymore. He told Bernie, I pretended I hadn't seen anything, because I wasn't sure if Bradstrup might be the one who killed her. And there he was with both his arms around my neck. Dieter had never received any exhilaration from fear. His older brother had died in Egypt when he himself was 11, and his brother had been executed by guillotine in Linz. By the time Dieter himself was a soldier and was made sergeant to fight in Waffen, there was no winnable war to fight in. Waffen SS 14-year-olds were assigned to hundreds of platoons to prevent non-commissioned officers like Dieter from surrendering to the Amis. That meant constant low-level fear, which he disliked almost as much as high-level fear. He wasn't the least interested in bravery. Not back then, not now. Bernie let himself down the embankment, bent over the corpse, but touched nothing. Then he scrambled back up to the cruise car, told his deputy to get out of the back and into the driver's seat, put Dieter in back, and himself got into the front of the passenger side. He turned himself 3/4 around so they could talk to each other's faces. Tell me everything, he said. Start at the beginning. Dieter described finding the mother bear and her cubs in his apple trees. The policeman did not hurry him. From time to time, he asked a question. What gave you the idea that Bradstrup might have killed that girl? Dieter said, he told me that while he was stuck in the trap, he didn't hear any rifle shots. Yet I had heard, too. If he was lying, there must be a reason. I guess then that he himself fired one of those shots, then caught in the trap and began calling for help. Then when I answered him, he probably threw away the rifle so I wouldn't see it. He added, of course he didn't kill that girl this morning, if he killed her at all. How so? The police said quickly, because her eye sockets were filled with snow melt. Okay, Bernie said. Thank you, Dieter. Give this tired man a ride home, he said to the deputy. The young cop kept eyeing up the rearview mirror, his eyes under the visor like two muzzles pointed back at Dieter. He had the metallic voice of a completely confident person. Whoever they are, he was saying, we'll get them. We always do. Like with 9/11, we'll get those people too. Take it all peacefully, Dieter told himself. Peaceful. Peaceful. This guy was just one more 20-year-old like any other 20-year-old, wanting to make an arrest, or even better, wanting to shoot someone and attempting to escape. Well, Dieter himself was just an old man now, an old man growing strawberries outside a tiny American town, and no one was going to want to pick him up for anything.
You've been listening to Episode 1 of Shelter Half by Minnesota author Carol Bly. This book will run for 20 episodes through July 23rd. If you miss a day, remember that all the week's episodes are posted on our website, ktwh.org, on the Literally from the North Shore page, on the Programs drop-down menu at the top of the homepage. Be sure to tune in again for the next episode of Shelter Half.